Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Until only a few years ago, there was no question in any of our minds that the world respected and acknowledged the United States as a great and irresistible power for good and peace in the world. From World War II through the Vietnam War, there was literally a 20th century Pax Romana, in this case, a Pax Americana. Apart from enlightened leadership, our global preeminent position was a product of cooperation between the two major political parties addressing the country's foreign policy on a nonpartisan basis. For at least a generation, America was effectively the enforcer of international peace and harmony. So, what a shock to look at our foreign policy landscape today. Literally a barren, sun-scorched desert of partisan political warfare. And as a result, much of the world no longer admires, fears, or hardly even cooperates with us. So we ask, what happened? Like every serious and deep problem, there are no quick and easy answers, which brings us to our speaker today, who is arguably the finest authority in the country on this subject. He will walk us through the historical context and then discuss possible solutions to this very real dilemma. Dr. Charles Kupchan is Professor of International Relations at Georgetown University. He is also a Senior Fellow and Director of European Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and was the Henry Kissinger Scholar at the Library of Congress. He was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council. Before joining the NSC, he worked in the State Department on the policy planning staff. Prior to government service, he was an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University. Dr. Kupchan got his undergraduate at Harvard and his master's and doctorate at Oxford. He has served as a visiting scholar at Harvard Center for International Affairs, Columbia's Institute for War and Peace Studies, and the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. He has written 7 books on international relations. His most recent is The End of the American Era, Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order. He has written numerous articles for magazines and newspapers and has appeared on every major television network. This was his 3rd appearance before our group here in Dallas over the last 10 years. Please help me welcome Dr. Charles Kupchan.
Thank you, Mel, for the flattering introduction, and to Phil, AJC, the World Affairs Council. It's a pleasure to be back in Dallas and to have an opportunity to share some thoughts with you again this afternoon. The topic that louder. The topic that ostensibly I am going to talk about this afternoon is the United States, a superpower, finds its limits. And you would assume that if I were to spend the next 20 or 30 minutes talking about that, I might discuss what's going on in Iraq or Afghanistan or how little leverage we have in Pakistan. We don't seem to be able to get the Israelis and the Palestinians to move in the direction of peace. The Russians seem to do the exact opposite of what we want them to do. India, China, on an upward trajectory. So you could look out at the world and say, well, there are a lot of reasons that the United States is finding the limits of its power, and that's because it's a difficult world. We are facing rising challengers on many different fronts. The situation in Iraq has, to some extent, raised questions about how much actual influence our preponderant military power buys us. And so one could talk about this topic of a superpower finding its limits exclusively from the perspective of what's going on in the outside world. But I'm not going to talk about any of that. I'm going to talk about what's going on here in the United States. And that's because I think the most interesting and the most profound constraints on American power are not the Russians, the Chinese, the Indians, what's going on in Iraq, but it's ourselves. And it's the degree to which the United States seems to have lost the consensus about the nature of its engagement in the world that it enjoyed for the last 50 years, arguably from Pearl Harbor through the middle, if not the late, 1990s. If you watch the news in the evening or read the newspapers, or at least in Washington, you hear it on the streets, you might surmise that the United States today is more polarized, more politically charged, more confrontational than it's been in many decades. And it's not just Republicans and Democrats that are going after each other. As we saw on Monday night, Democrats are also going after each other in a way that was not particularly uplifting. And if you look at the data, the people who crunch the numbers on public opinion, people who crunch the numbers on votes in Congress, you would in fact find that this impression that we lived in a polarized America is in fact quite accurate. And if you look at Congress, for example, you will find that the House of Representatives and the Senate have not been so polarized, so politically divided since the 19th century. And if you look at public opinion, you will find that the gap between Democrats and Republicans is as big as it has been since the pre-World War II era. And what's particularly interesting about the nature of the divide that's opening up in the country is that it's not just about domestic policy. If you look at the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, right through the last decade, you will find that we always had serious disagreements about taxes, guns, abortion, gay marriage. But that when it came to questions of foreign policy, we generally came together. And the issues over which we disagreed were relatively minor. That's no longer the case. We are now more polarized as a country on questions of foreign policy than we are on questions of domestic policy. Just to give you one quick piece of public opinion polling, the week after David Petraeus testified before Congress about the surge, 80% of Democrats said that they wanted all American troops out of Iraq within 1 year. About the same number of Republicans, 75%, said that they wanted the United States to stay in Iraq until the mission has been completed, whatever that is. But that gives you a sense that among the American public, one party wants the hell out, the other party is ready to stay put, even if it takes another 5 to 10 years. And this is the defining foreign policy issue for the country at this moment. And so what I'd like to do is, as Mel put it, answer the question, what happened? How did we get here? Why is it that we seem to confront a political system in which the bipartisan centrist foundations of foreign policy have come undone? The easy answer is that this has been a particularly polarizing presidency. that George W. Bush, unlike many of his predecessors, catered to his base, not to the center, that he launched a war in Iraq that proved to be particularly unpopular, and that as a result, the country has fallen upon hard times in terms of bipartisanship. I'm going to give you an answer that says that this is not a problem that stems principally from George W. Bush. And as some of you may know, I'm not a big fan of this administration, so I'm not here to make apologies for it. But I am here to suggest that this administration is as much a symptom as a cause of deeper structural changes that are taking place in the world and in American politics. And the sobering analysis that comes out of that is that come January 2009, we will still face a country that is polarized and divided, that doesn't know its mind on how it wants to engage with the world. Because it's not just about this administration. Something bigger is going on. And the core of the argument that I want to make is that in the 1940s, under Roosevelt's watch, and really for the first time in American history, American leaders put together a bipartisan coalition behind what I would call liberal internationalism. Liberal internationalism being a compact between two different types of international engagement. Liberal in that it was open, multilateral, and internationalist in that we as a country agreed to engage in the world, to project our power abroad. And that this bipartisan consensus came together for both geopolitical and domestic reasons. Geopolitically, because we faced Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, and then the Soviet Union, and we needed to project our power abroad to prevent the domination of Eurasia by hostile power, but we couldn't do it alone. We needed friends and allies and bases. And therefore, we reached out to others at the same time that we agreed to take a leadership position. And then domestically, Roosevelt governed at a time in which the opportunities to forge a bipartisan center were unique and unprecedented. The North and South came together for the first time, and I'll explain why. The post-World War II boom diminished the role of ideology in American politics. The moderate bloc in Congress, which had been tiny prior to the 1940s, became more and more dominant. American citizens became less and less polarized over the nature of their country's engagement in the world. And as a result, the soil, the political soil, was ripe for someone to come and put together this broad centrist coalition behind liberal internationalism. Well, what's happened is that compact, that bipartisan center, has come apart. And it started to come apart well before George W. Bush came to office, which is one of the reasons that I don't think it's just about Bush. I would say that it came apart in three stages. One, the end of the Cold War. Two, the 94 elections, in which the Republicans took control of Congress and began to confront the Clinton administration over liberal internationalism. And three, September 11, which created a very different international environment than existed during the Soviet Union. So let me back up and sort of give you some history as to where the bipartisan center came from and why it now seems to be in such disrepair. And as you can see from the projector here, I'm going to be drawing on an article that I just published with a friend of mine, Peter Trubowitz, who is down the road in Austin. In fact, I'm getting on a plane after this session to go have dinner with Peter tonight. So this is a co-authored work, and anything you like about the talk I wrote and anything you don't like, direct your questions to Peter. As I mentioned, Roosevelt presided over a unique moment in American politics And if you go and look at the pre-Roosevelt era, you will see a country that really didn't know what to make of its power. And if you look at American grand strategy from the period during which we turned on as a great power in the 1890s up until 1941, you will see that we were politically and in terms of our foreign policy a mess. Sometimes we were all about power, Teddy Roosevelt, the White Fleet, imperialism, picking a war with Spain, colonizing the Philippines, Hawaii, decided by the middle of the next decade, the early part of the 1900s, that we weren't so wild about that. Then we get Woodrow Wilson, who's at the far end of the other spectrum. He doesn't want America to be a great imperial power. He wants us to join the League of Nations, to disarm, free trade, end of secret diplomacy. He's the president of partnership. And then we get to a situation politically where we couldn't build a consensus around power, and we couldn't build a consensus around partnership. Keep in mind that the Senate voted down resoundingly American participation in Wilson's League of Nations. And so these competing visions of American foreign policy ended up vetoing each other. And what do you get when the political system is locked by veto? You get the lowest common denominator, which is we did nothing. And so in the 20s and 30s, we essentially retreated from American engagement in the world because we couldn't agree on anything other than doing nothing. That then changes in the 1940s, and it changes in part because of Roosevelt's leadership. He looked carefully at why Wilson lost the battle to get the United States in to the League of Nations and to make the United States an international leader. And Wilson was defeated in part because unilateralists and isolationists wanted nothing to do with American multilateral engagement in the world. And he was also defeated in part because he was extraordinarily partisan. And he and Henry Cabot Lodge, the main detractor in the Senate, were fierce enemies. And the Democrats ended up unwilling to make any concessions to the Republicans on the League of Nations. And the Republicans said, we want nothing to do with the League that Wilson has on offer. And as a result, there was no political compromise. Well, Roosevelt said, I'm not going to make that same mistake. And we know a lot about what Roosevelt did in World War II, the conduct of American military strategy. But behind the scenes, he was working tirelessly to build a bipartisan coalition. He reached out to Wendell Willkie, the Republican he defeated in 1940. He sent him on a world tour. Willkie published a book called One World to drum up American internationalism. Roosevelt brought Republicans into the administration. Every time he would dispatch some sort of commission abroad, there were Republicans, prominent Republicans. When he thought about the United Nations and what the UN Charter was going to say, he always ran it by Republicans before he put it out there because he wanted to get buy-in. He wanted to make sure that they were on board. He didn't want to make the same mistakes that Wilson made. And that led to a situation in which, for the first time, Democrats and Republicans came together on a common platform about American foreign policy. It was really the era in which the bipartisan center was born. And that bipartisanship was critical to the emergence of liberal internationalism for three main reasons. One, it meant that Republicans and Democrats were going to hold their fire. And again, keep in mind that at that time, most American politicians in Congress and in the Senate were not very internationalists. There were lots of John Boltons around. There were lots of Pat Buchanans and Ron Pauls. There weren't many Chuck Hagels or Richard Lugers or George H.W. Bushes, right? Those are late 20th century, post-World War II foreign policy people. And so to get out there and argue for the UN and argue for American power in Europe and American troops in Japan was extraordinarily risky. It was political suicide, unless you knew that the other party was going to go along with you. The second reason that bipartisanship was critical is that this is a country that, even though it gives the president the power of the commander-in-chief, gives the Congress a lot of control over money and over treaties. To get into NATO, to create the Bretton Woods system, to pass any significant treaty through the Senate, you need two-thirds. So even when one party is in pretty strong control of the White House, of the Senate, of Congress, you still can't do it on your own. Founding fathers put a high bar for international treaties. And that means that unless there is a bipartisan center, we won't be a multilateral power. We won't build international institutions simply because we can't get them through the Senate. And finally, bipartisanship provided for constancy, for continuity. It meant that liberal internationalism was going to outlast Roosevelt. Otherwise, it may have just been a fleeting phenomenon. But precisely because Republicans and Democrats alike embraced it, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and those who came after essentially pursued the same grand strategy and had the same political support from both sides of the aisle. Now, where did this come from? How did this happen? As I said, I think it's a mix of external and internal forces. Externally, the Soviet Union, like Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, required the United States to engage in the world and required partnerships to do it. We didn't have the power. We didn't have the bases. At that time, we didn't have B-52 bombers that could fly from the continental United States to the Soviet Union. We needed to put them in the Middle East. We needed troops on the inner German border. You can't do that without alliances. And conditions at home were also quite ripe for the onset of bipartisanship. And let me just give you a glimpse of what happens once you get to Pearl Harbor and the rise of Roosevelt and the bipartisan coalition. As you can see, until that period, foreign policy and domestic policy basically ran along parallel lines in terms of how many votes were bipartisan and how many votes were partisan. That then breaks off quite dramatically after World War II begins. And then roughly 3 out of every 4 votes on foreign policy were bipartisan until the Vietnam War, with a slight exception during the Korean War, but it was quite temporary. Now, why was this possible? As I mentioned, part of it was Roosevelt and the fact that he reached across the aisle. But part of it was a change in the domestic landscape here at home. For the first time in American history, the North and the South came together to back a similar foreign policy. And throughout American history, the North and the South had been on different sides of our key foreign policy debates. The North was generally protectionist because it wanted to industrialize, and it was pro-defense spending because they wanted the U.S. to turn into a modern great power like the U.K. The South, in contrast, was a free trading section because they wanted to sell tobacco and cotton all over the world, and they were anti-defense spending, which you might sort of scratch your head about because today the South tends to be more pro-defense than any other part of the country. At that time, they were anti-defense spending because they feared that a large central government with a major navy and a major army would imperil domestic liberty. And therefore, they wanted the militias of the states to do our fighting, not some dangerous federal entity. And as a result, the North and the South were really on different sides of most foreign policy debates through the late 19th century. And importantly, sections or regions and parties ran along parallel lines. That wasn't true until the 1850s. If you look, for example, at where the party of the North, the Whigs, got their votes prior to the 1850s, they got them from the North and the South. Where did the Democrats, the party of the South, get votes? They got some in the North and some in the South. And that was a good thing because that meant that parties were pushed to take positions that could win votes in both sections, and it pushed them to the center. What happened in 1855 is that the South got the Missouri Compromise repealed. Missouri Compromise had one slave state for one free state. The North was very pissed off about this. And what happened is it gave birth to the Republican Party. And the Republican Party was the party of anti-slavery, and it became the party of the North. The Democrats were forced to become the party of the South to protect slavery. And from 1855 until 1861, when war broke out, our political parties represented regions, single regions. The Republicans became the party of the North, and the Democrats were the party of the South, and that was really the beginning of the slide to civil war. That separation of Republicans in the North and Democrats in the South continued until Roosevelt was in office. And it changed while he was there, in part because the North had warmed up to the idea of free trade because they had great industries at that point, and they continued to be supportive of defense spending. And the South had warmed up to defense spending because a lot of the bases and the military industries that opened in World War II opened in the South. Moreover, a lot of Democrats who lived in the South moved to the North to get jobs because that's where the industries were opening. And so instead of having one party in the North and one party in the South that disagreed, Roosevelt suddenly had voters in the North and voters in the South. Democrats and Republicans, again, like they did before 1855, had to cater to both major sections of the country. And that meant that the North sent Democrats and Republicans to Congress, the South sent Democrats and Republicans to Congress. The vital center, as Arthur Schlesinger put it, came to life. It's also the case that the post-World War II economic boom reduced the deep ideological debates of the Depression era. And as a result, people began to moderate ideologically, as you'll see here. This is an indicator of members of Congress who would fall in the ideological center. And as you can see, beginning in the 1940 period, it climbs dramatically from where it was before. And this corresponds to what many sociologists and political scientists call the age of the end of ideology, Daniel Bell, for example, because Americans were all benefiting from the benefits of global integration, from the benefits of industrialization, and as a result, the ideological divide began to narrow. And this narrowing was reflected not just in Congress, but also in the public. And here is a slide that shows that there really was very little polarization within the American electorate about the Soviet threat and the nature of American engagement with the Soviet Union. That graph is also an indication, I think, of the fact that there was not partisan polarization. That is to say that there were times when the public mind shifted, more hawkish, less hawkish. But Republicans and Democrats alike moved in the same direction. It wasn't that the Democrats went this way and the Republicans went that way, even during the Vietnam period. It was a polarizing period, but that polarization did not split along partisan lines. So that's the historical flashback. Now let me fast forward to the 1990s. What's happened? And in many respects, the 1990s were the mirror image of the 1940s. The 1990s were the decade in which that bipartisan center, this moderate, that this moderate bloc, that pattern of bipartisan voting began to give way to this, a rapid decline in bipartisanship in the U.S. Congress that really came up briefly toward the end of the late 1990s, spiked after 9/11, and then fell back down. If you were to continue that graph to 2007, it would fall well below domestic policy. Why has this happened? Why is it that after five decades of bipartisanship on foreign policy, we now seem to be heading in the other direction? Part of the answer is external. A unipolar world, a world with only one pole of power, gives the United States less reason to be disciplined, less reason to put foreign policy above partisan politics, because we didn't have the same incentive that we did during the Soviet Union to come together. 9/11 comes along, and you might say, well, 9/11 should have provided the cause for us to come back together, just like Pearl Harbor did. And in fact, many of my colleagues in the ivory towers said 9/11 will be the Pearl Harbor of the 21st century. Not only will we re-engage in the world, but we will restore a bipartisan consensus. Well, it didn't happen. And it didn't happen in part because of the nature of the threat. Terrorism is much more elusive, sporadic, difficult than a state-based threat. It does not require national mobilization in the same way that fighting Nazi Germany or the Cold War did. In fact, the general message that we've been told for the last 7 years is, we're at war, but please go shopping. We're at war, but please take a vacation so that people are on our airplanes. And so it sends a very confusing signal to the American public about the nature of the threat that we face. And it is the case that at the low level, but beneath the radar screen, the U.S. has become very multilateral, but it's mostly on the soft, quiet stuff. Police action, freezing assets, exchanging information. On the big questions of use of force, generally, terrorism invites unilateralism. The country that gets hit is the country that fights back. When the British got bombed by the IRA, they were alone in responding. When the French got hit by the Algerians, they were alone. When Israel faces a bomb going off in one of its buses, the United States is not flying air cover when the retaliation takes place. It's a very different kind of threat. And then here at home, I think what we're seeing is in many respects the unraveling of those transformational changes that took place during the 1940s. We no longer have a North-South divide, but we do have a red-blue divide. And unfortunately, our parties, which used to be cross-regional and cross-sectional, are, like after 1855, starting to represent homogeneous regions. In other words, rather than having the New Englanders send very heterogeneous delegations, they're now sending Democrats. It's very hard to find a Republican in Vermont. On the other hand, the Southern delegations and the delegations from the Mountain West tend to be primarily Republican. And so what you're seeing is a return to an America in which the parties no longer have a strong incentive to cater to the center because they are appealing to voters of one ideological persuasion. I don't think we're heading back to what happened last time we had that situation, civil war, but it is worrying that section and party are now coming back into alignment. And this is a story that has pretty long roots. Mel and I were discussing last night about when this transformation began, and it really began under Lyndon Johnson and the civil rights movement. That's when the Democrats lost their foothold in the South. That's when the Republicans also began to lose their foothold in the North. Who did Roosevelt reach out to when he built the bipartisan coalition? He reached out to the so-called Rockefeller Republicans, the folks up in New York and New England. They're gone. There really isn't a serious, moderate, centrist caucus in the Republican Party. And in general, the Republicans have a lock on what people call, demographers call, the Big L, the Mountain West coming down and then running eastward into the mid-Atlantic. And the Democrats have the two coasts and the upper Midwest. And again, with that kind of regional segregation underneath our political segregation, it gives the parties very little incentive to run to the center. Another change that is adding to this is we are now facing an economy that is slowing down. And therefore, instead of having ideological moderation, we're getting this: the demise of the moderate bloc in Congress. There are other reasons for this other than the slowing economy. Congressional redistricting certainly hasn't helped. The media is disastrous from this perspective. It's not just one cable station or another. They're all now basically either human interest story or political fisticuffs. And as a result, we're seeing a very polarized debate, and people tending to move to the ideological extremes in the public as well as in Congress. Another development that I think is contributing to this is generational change. As someone who lives in Washington and has a certain amount of contact with members of Congress, the World War II generation really brings a different spirit to the table than those that are coming into office now. They lived through World War II and the rebuilding of Europe. They cut their teeth on bipartisanship. Members of Congress or the Senate who are in their 30s and 40s today generally do not know members of the opposite party, partly because their schedules, they fly in on Tuesday, they caucus with their own party, and they go home on Thursday. There aren't dinner parties on Saturday night where Republicans and Democrats are getting together to break bread. And one can kind of feel this in the streets in terms of the absence of discussion and dialogue between the two parties. This, as I mentioned at the beginning, is spilling out into the public domain with the polarization of the U.S. electorate over defense spending shown here. If I put up a graph of polarization over the Iraq War, it would be even more pronounced. And in general, the Republicans are becoming a party that believes that the use of force is the best way to protect America. The Democrats tend to become the party that believes in the use of diplomacy as the best way to protect America, but most of us all know that you got to put the two together if the United States is going to protect itself. And that coming together is not going to happen if one party's in that corner of the room and the other party is that corner of the room or not even in the same building. Let me close by offering some suggestions on what we do now. There are those politicians, Barack Obama among them, who believe that the country needs to come back together. And obviously, one of the central messages that I will leave with you today is I agree. And my guess is that many of you do as well. The problem, though, is that many of the issues that I've been talking about are structural in nature. Right? It's not just about Bush and Cheney and Karl Rove telling them to run to the right. It's about deeper changes in the world and deeper changes in the American body politic. And as a result of that, it seems to me that that we need to do more than simply say, let there be bipartisanship. We have to have our own domestic strategy for rebuilding a consensus. And I would go so far to say as that the greatest challenge facing the president that takes office in January 2009 will be bringing our foreign policy and our domestic politics back into alignment. Because right now they are woefully out of balance. And let me just read to you a quote from Walter Lippmann, one of the most lucid commentators on American policy, and this comes from the early 1940s. When a people is divided within itself about the conduct of its foreign relations, it is unable to agree on the determination of its true interest. It is unable to prepare adequately for war or to safeguard successfully its peace. The spectacle of this great nation, that's us, which does not know its own mind, is as humiliating as it is dangerous. Lippmann was wrong in 1941 when he wrote it because he didn't know what Roosevelt was about to do. Unfortunately, he may have been prescient about where we are headed now. And so I will just leave you with three generic thoughts on how to tackle this problem. First is that I think that if there is to be a new equilibrium politically, it will be based on a grand strategy that does less, not more. That if Democrats and Republicans are going to find common ground, it's on the basis of a grand strategy that is more selective, more judicious, not isolationist, but less onerous than the one that we have today. Because I think the bottom is falling off of the policies that we're pursuing today. That means more reliance on others. It means encouraging the Europeans and the Japanese and the Indians to step up to the plate and do more to share global burdens. A second general admonition would be less ideology and more pragmatism. I think Americans are desperate for competence. They are desperate for not grandiose visions of the democratization of the Middle East, but simply for putting one foot in front of the next and getting the job done. And so I would encourage the next president not to get all wrapped up in the vision thing and articulate a new grand strategy, but simply to sort of make the trains run on time, to get us through the day on the key foreign policy problems, to work with whatever partners are willing to work with us. And here I think the Bush administration does leave an important and valuable legacy, and that is coalitions of the willing. What have been the most useful diplomatic vehicles of the last 5 or 6 years? It's not the UN Security Council. I don't even think it's NATO and the big institutions. It's the contact group on the Balkans. It's the quartet in the Middle East. It's the EU3 US team negotiating with Iran. It's the six-party talks on North Korea. It's pragmatism. It's put parties at the table who have an interest in dealing with the issue and get the job done. Finally, I think the next president is going to have to be very strategic in building political alliances. I don't think that, for example, one could do the, what's the name of that film about baseball, Build It and They Will Come? Bull Durham?
Field of Dreams.
Right, build it and they will come. Right, if we go build a nice big bipartisan house now, they will not come. Right, we have to go get them. And so that means to me that we need to look for discrete political alliances. Evangelicals on the right coming to hook up with pro-environmentalists on the left because they share that goal. Big business on the right with left-leaning immigration advocates on the left because they share a goal of having good access to labor. International institutions which Democrats may support for ideological reasons we might get Republicans to buy into them for pragmatic reasons, because institutions are ways of getting help from others, of restoring fiscal solvency to our foreign policy. In other words, we need to go out there and find partners on two sides of what is now a gaping aisle who might not agree on everything, but who can agree on discrete projects to put our foreign policy back on a sound political footing. So the strategy that I would advocate is one of selective engagement, not because I think the United States doesn't continue to need robust American leadership, but because I think we need to pull back a little bit if we're going to restore a consensus in this country. And that more judicious grand strategy is really one that's calibrated to what I see as a country that will be polarized for the foreseeable future, a country in which a downturn in the economy will make us perhaps more protectionist, a country in which the debate over migration is going to continue to roil the political waters. There's no escaping those, but I think what we can do is recognize that we now live in a different political landscape, and that we all need to work very hard if we're going to do what Roosevelt did, and that is try to put back a bipartisan coalition, a bipartisan consensus behind America's engagement in the world. Otherwise, I fear we may be going back to the pre-World War II era when, to use Lippmann's phrase, a country that does not know its own mind is as humiliating as it is dangerous. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You see what I mean? This is tremendous. All right, now we have a unique way of handling questions at this event. To save time, there are always a lot of questions. We take three questions at a time, and then our speaker will answer them in order or whatever order he sees fit. So with the questions we have in the audience, let me see some hands. Right there. Yeah.
Just curious, some years ago I read something where a German economist, et cetera, said that the optimal size of the city was around 1 million because you had the benefits of a large city without the logistics problems associated with that, and countries somewhere around 50 to 60 million. You also harkened back to the 1940s when the U.S. had around 120 million, fairly homogeneous population, 300 million people, very diverse, et cetera. Do you not feel that possibly the root of some of these issues in the United States potentially is becoming ungovernable just because of the sheer size and mass? And also, in the subset, might not a possible solution be what other democratic countries is, like the Netherlands with 15 million people, they have 15 serious political parties. The United States with 300 million people, that's two. Anyway.
Good question.
Okay, next question. Okay.
Obviously, we have a polarization between the Democrats and the Republicans. Would you comment on what you feel is the role or what's going to happen with regard to the moderate people that are in the middle? Most of the politicians call them the independents.
Okay. There.
I'm just sort of a beginner here, and I'd like to go back a little bit in history and clarify this for me, please, but Woodrow Wilson's idea of the League of Nations was to end war, is the way I understand it, and then comes Roosevelt, and what was his most elemental important bottom line purpose in the UN? Okay, somebody, thank you.
Okay.
On the this size question, I'm not sure that it's size as much as the increasing diversity of who we are. And there are several different dimensions to the problem. I think one is that migration in an era of globalization is changing the United States, it's changing our major allies in ways that I think we are just beginning to understand. This issue is particularly relevant for this part of the country. I'm someone who believes that Hispanic immigration is changing the United States, fundamentally changing the United States. I'm not someone like Sam Huntington who goes, oh my God, you know, what are we going to do? We got to build a wall. But I think we will probably be a bilingual country in the next 10 or 20 years, that our geographic focus will be more Western hemispheric than it used to be. And that's fine. Good. I mean, that's just the way the world works. But it is also, and it makes it confusing for politicians to figure out. And it is, I think, it is part of the reason that the polarization is getting so intense, in the sense that immigration breeds nativism. Immigration breeds populism. In Europe, it's doing exactly the same thing. There, the problem is more Muslims from North Africa and Turkey and the Middle East. But the reaction is sort of generally the same. One group is saying integrate, and the other group is saying kick them out and build a wall. And that's because it's socially dislocating. I have to say I find it that way. I mean, I at work at the Council on Foreign Relations, and the cleaning crew comes in every night. I cannot speak a word to them. I don't speak any Spanish. They don't speak a word of English. I find, you know, it takes getting used to, but that's new. That's different. Another factor that I think is important is the digital age, and that the digital age is to some extent reversing the mixing bowl that was fired by the industrial era. In the industrial era, you had to go here, right, to get a job. Why was it that so many Democrats moved from the South to the North in the 40s and 50s? It's because that's where the big jobs were, right? Now, in the digital era, you go where you want to because you don't need to live at the port to get the job. You don't need to go to the river city. And I think that is creating an America in which people of one kind of group live here, people of another kind of group live there. That's part of the reason that we're seeing red and blue America. So I think those sorts of issues are more important than the sheer size issue. And on the Hispanic front, my guess is we just don't have a lot of good data on this, but that I don't think this wave of immigration will be like previous waves. It's too big. People go back and forth. I mean, my grandparents came from Ukraine in the 1920s. And they never looked back. No one ever went back. No one ever spoke a word of Ukrainian or Yiddish, right? It was like integrated into America. That's not going to be the case looking forward. On the role of independence, it's a very good question. I don't have a good answer to it. I obviously independents are going to be very, very important. And independents, in many respects, explain the Democratic victory in the midterms of 2006. A lot of people coded that result as, aha, America's center is coming back to life. I don't see it that way. I think that the Democrats did well in the midterms because of the war. I think that a Democrat will be in the White House in January because of the war. And that independents are going to be going sort of, once the war is behind us and it's no longer the central issue, I think we will sort of return to a world in which the independents are more divided and flock to both left and right. On Wilson versus Roosevelt, Wilson made the mistake of being an absolutist in the sense of, if you look at Article 10 of the League of Nations Charter, it basically creates a binding legal commitment for the United States to get involved to stop aggression wherever it might occur. And Henry Cabot Lodge and the Republicans said to him, we can't sign this agreement. Right? What if there's a fight somewhere in the Sudan, to pick a place, the Janjaweed and the Darfur? Do we legally have to go and clean up every problem that exists on the world? And Wilson said, yes, we do. And the Senate said, goodbye and no thank you. Roosevelt was much more of a pragmatist. And he said, we will create a commitment in a hortatory way. We will do good in the world, but we're not going to take on these kind of binding commitments that will scare off unilateralists and that will scare off isolationists. And so his view of America's engagement in the world was much more contingent, much more a mix of idealism and realism, avoided articles like Article 10 that would have raised red flags for the Republicans when they voted on the UN. And it's because of that pragmatism and because he mixed realism and idealism that he was much more successful in getting the United States to buy into liberal internationalism than was Wilson.
Okay, three more questions. Right, one.
You mentioned earlier the media. I was wondering if you might elaborate a little bit as to how much you feel the media is responsible for kind of driving the wedge of divisiveness in our political
thinking. Next, another question.
I like your analysis, which is very strategic, but I wondered if you'd also comment on two other elements I think have been very profound, and they're very simple. One is the rise to dominance of the left within the Democratic Party, pushing aside the Scoop Jacksons, the Sam Nunns, the David Borens in the party, and their perspective of a bipartisan foreign policy. The other dynamic is the fact that we have fewer and fewer and fewer veterans in the Congress now. So the Congress is almost by definition more insular, more partisan, less global in perspective, and frankly, less global in experience.
What, right there.
What is the effect of the loss of our manufacturing to overseas have on our foreign policy?
On the media issue, I'm going to broaden out a little bit and include the internet in that, because there was originally a lot of optimism that the internet was going to make us a more informed and articulate and deliberate electorate. And it seems to be doing the opposite. And that's in part because, you know, we plug in to the site that we want, and it's probably one that we agree with. And we set up, you know, listservs and messages, and so we're getting our information from this group of people or that group of people, and we're not all tuning in to broad, relatively centrist sources of information in the same way that we were before the internet revolution. And on the media, you know, my sense is that it does have a very negative effect, because it's such a powerful medium. A lot of people watch television. And the reason that the media has moved in the direction that it has moved in is quite simple. It's money. It's advertising dollars. And that's why, you know, look at CNN. 5 years ago, I hope no one here works for CNN, but CNN was a reasonably serious network. It's not now. CNN International is, but not CNN Domestic. And, you know, I'll just give you one anecdote. A friend of mine used to be the senior producer for CNN from 7 to 9 o'clock. So this was when Paul Azan was on, and I guess he was followed by...
I don't know what happened to her.
Yeah, I don't either. Maybe Anderson Cooper. I can't remember exactly, but he got fired. And one of the reasons he got fired is because he didn't do what they told him to do, which was essentially he had to get a certain number of viewers to stay from one show to the next for something like 18 seconds instead of 10 seconds. And they wanted him to, you know, start the news with some drivel or some story about what wife blew what husband's brains out because, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it was all about, you know, this many viewers for 8 more seconds. And that's, it's just, it's money. What do we do about that? I don't know. Because, you know, where, as far as I can tell, you know, if you watch television and you want serious hard news today, it's either BBC or it's Lehrer. And there's not much else. On the left in the Democratic Party, it's an excellent question, and it's a problem. I would say that on balance, the Republican Party has moved further to the right than the Democratic Party has moved to the left, but they're both moving away from the center, one a little bit faster and further than the other. And the Republicans, I think, in part because their centrist caucus is now so slim. The few independents and centrists that were part of the Republican Party lost in the 2006 midterms. And this reordering that I talked about earlier is particularly problematic in the sense that it was a good thing when the Democrats had the South, because then the more left-leaning party had its political base in the most conservative part of the country. And it was good that the Republicans had the North, because the North was the most liberal, and that pushed the Republicans in a liberal direction. But when you flip it, and the Republicans own the South and the Democrats own the North, then there's nobody pushing them to the center. In the Democratic Party, I think that there's a battle going on. And it's a battle between what I would call the party activists, the grassroots activists, that are pretty far to the left, and between the party elites that are much more centrist. It's, in some ways, it's sort of the DLC against the DNC, if you follow Washington politics. It's not clear who's going to win, but it's been interesting to watch the candidates flail around. For example, I would have never guessed in January of last year that Hillary Clinton would have endorsed legislation that tied funding for the war to a pullout, which she did. And that's because, you know, she is a centrist. She's a bit of a hawk in Democratic terms. And she wants to demonstrate her bona fides on security. But why did she vote for that? Because she was trying to win the Democratic nomination. And the people who vote in primaries tend to be party activists, and those party activists are pretty far to the left. So I'd say there's a battle going on right now for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party, between its centrist wing and its left wing. The left is more numerous. The centrist is more elite and more powerful. I don't know who's going to win.
Actually, we'll have time for one more question.
The loss of manufacturing is a problem, and it adds to the phenomenon that I've been talking about in the following sense, that international openness, free trade, was an important plank of the liberal internationalist agenda. And as I said, this was an issue over which the North and South were long divided. And finally, they come together in the middle of the 20th century, and then we're basically pro-free trade right up until the present day. And the loss of manufacturing jobs is I think, ultimately going to push the country, and particularly the Democrats, in a more protectionist direction. And that's simply because if you look at the big swing states, like Ohio, like Michigan, they have a large manufacturing sector that is suffering. And if you look at what Obama and Clinton and Edwards, particularly Edwards, have been saying about this, they are quite openly backing away from free trade. And once, were that to happen, were we to begin to walk away from new free trade agreements, a liberal open international economy, then liberal internationalism is even more under threat. My guess is that's where we're heading. And that's because we're now coupling the deindustrialization that Lou Dobbs likes to talk about every night and every night and every night with a downturn in that's being caused by the credit crunch. And that's a, and then let's throw in the subprime thing just for the hell of it. That's a, that, that's, you know, that can really take the wind out of the sails of America's appetite for globalization.
Okay, one more question right there.
Yes, sir. So follow on about your comments about the regional realignment of the parties. Thank you. I hate to admit it, but I was reading USA Today a day or two after the 2000 presidential election, and it had red counties and blue counties. And if you looked at that map, even in the blue states, the majority, the rural counties were red and the urban counties were blue. I mean, you saw this in Illinois where Chicago was blue, et cetera, versus downstate. Is there a rural versus urban divide that's driving this? And the swing voters are really not swing states like Ohio or Michigan, but they're the suburban voters.
Shall we take one more? There was a hand.
Okay, yeah.
She was trying
we'll
to get
one
in
more
for
more.
It.
That gentleman asked part of the same question. My other one was, could you comment on David Boren, the, his name came up, David Boren and Michael Bloomberg and the group that met at the University of Oklahoma, specifically about process and bipartisanship?
There's no question that there is an urban-rural thing going on, and that you're right to point out that if you, you know, look at the micro scale rather than the macro scale, you get more purple than red and blue because, you know, this county, which is more urbanized, tends to be this way, and rural voters tend to be that way. And it, you know, it's interesting, as just as an aside, I've been writing a book now about how enemies become friends, long-standing rivalries that end in friendship. And one of the variables that I'm finding that is important in determining when that happens is underlying social orders, rural versus urban. And so I've been looking at unions that form in Switzerland, for example. You know, what was the main divide in the Swiss Confederation between 1290, when it began life, and 1848, when they finally stopped killing each other? The rural cantons versus the urban cantons. And that was then turned into a divide over religion because the cities went Protestant and the farmers stayed Catholic. You find the same thing in Germany. Prussian commercialized and became Protestant. They couldn't get along with the people in Bavaria because they were conservative Catholic farmers. And so this is a problem that we've been running into throughout history. And it, you know, it stems, I think, from the acculturation, from the way of life that the two lifestyles tend to replicate. In some ways, it's good and bad news. It's good news because it means that we won't see a sort of hard partition in the same way that we did, let's say, in the 1860s, right? Because it's not going to be this part of the country is anti-slavery, and this part of the country is pro-slavery. Is going to be more complicated than that. It's a little bit troubling in that it suggests that there will be, you know, divides within divides, that you'll have urban communities and rural communities finding themselves at odds at the same time that we seem to be split at the national level. But there's no question it's an important cleavage. On the meeting that took place in Oklahoma, David Boren, Bloomberg, Gary Hart, I personally don't think it's going to go anywhere. And that's because the party machines in the United States are too powerful. And that I can see someone like Bloomberg making a difference by speaking up and maybe by even being a candidate and thereby shaping the debate. I don't think we're in a situation, and this comes back to an earlier question that someone referred to, the Netherlands, where we are really going to see a country that is no longer a two-party system. And that's probably not good news if the two parties are growing apart from each other. But part of the and part of the reason that I think that's the case is that it's all about fundraising, right? It's all about getting the party machine behind you and raising money so that you can buy time on television. And this is a whole nother topic, and we won't go there. Until we have a serious reform of our electoral system that creates a firewall between the money side and the political side, I don't think that there's going to be a change in the basic structure of the two-party system.
You say, in addition to Foreign Policy 101, we also had American Politics 101. Let's give our speaker a hand.
Thank you.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.